Are democratic processes in Latin America being influenced by the U.S.? What do the recent presidential elections in El Salvador tell us about the state of democracy in that country? Why does Venezuela seem to be less vulnerable to takeovers from abroad than other Latin American countries? Are the current protests there indicative of a U.S. attempt at a coup d'etat? On today's Global Research News Hour, we will get perspectives from two close observers of the region with an understanding of U.S. imperial agendas, author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Darius Nazemroya and Binghamton University Bartle Emeritus Professor of Sociology and author James Petras. On today's program, Undermining Democracy in Latin America, El Salvador, Venezuela, and Beyond. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 28th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM. In Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Of all the likely destinations for the missing flight, it seems incredible that would fly for 3 or more hours south only to ditch the plane in the water miles from any landmass. This latest conclusion is based almost solely on computer model data supplied by Inmarsat and as yet no physical proof that flight MH370 has actually crashed the location they are claiming it did. By contrast, an actual eyewitness sighting was reported the morning of the crash, but was more or less ignored by all governments and mainstream media outlets. Javeru Local News previously confirmed that, quote, residents of the remote Maldives island of Kuda Huvadu in Dal Atoll have reported seeing a low-flying jumbo jet on the morning of the disappearance of the Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. That's from the article, Flight MH370 Found? Not quite. Now the real whitewash begins, by 21st Century Wire, posted March 27th. The objective of the Obama administration's support for a coup to remove an essentially neutral Ukrainian government, though neighborly toward Russia, was to install a regime leaning toward and economically dependent upon the United States and the European Union. The purpose is to compromise Russia's revival as a regional power critical of U.S. policies. Washington was obviously disoriented by Russia's unexpected move in Ukraine, and perhaps even more so when Putin shrugged off President Obama's subsequent threats. From Moscow's point of view, however, the U.S. and EU made a deep penetration into Russia's long-recognized sphere of influence, and Putin had to respond with some degree of equivalence. He easily found it in Crimea. That's from Ukraine and the Geopolitical Chessboard by Jack A. Smith, posted March 26th. Obama's speech in Brussels was an attempt to justify a policy toward Russia that is aggressive, provocative, and incalculably dangerous. The real goal of U.S. actions in this crisis was suggested in the U.S. president's sneering reference on Tuesday to Russia as merely a regional power. This was not, of course, Obama's language when seeking to enlist Russian assistance in overthrowing the Assad government in Syria, browbeating Iran, or isolating North Korea. But it has been the goal of American imperialism ever since the collapse of the USSR to expand its influence throughout the former Soviet bloc, first in the countries of Eastern Europe, then in former Soviet republics in the Baltics, the Caucasus, and Central Asia, and now Ukraine. Russia is to be reduced not merely to the status of regional power, but to a semi-colonial status dismembered and carved up by the major imperialist powers. That's from the article, Obama's speech on Ukraine, Propaganda and Lies by Patrick Martin, posted March 27th, originally appearing at the World Socialist website. The purpose of the Washington-financed and orchestrated coup in Kiev was to put Ukraine, with its artificial boundaries, into the EU and NATO, and to evict Russia from its warm water port and ring Russia with U.S. missile bases. Washington and its European puppets describe this as, quote-unquote, bringing democracy to Ukraine. Washington's coup established for Ukraine the precedent that force and propaganda rule, not democracy. The government of China, having read Washington's war plans for war against China and being fully aware of Washington's pivot to Asia, in which the indispensable nation announced its safeguarding of peace by surrounding China with naval and air bases, understands that it has the same Washington enemy as does Russia. What the entire world faces, every country, every individual, regardless of their political orientation, is a Washington-engineered confrontation with Russia and China. That is from the article, Ukraine Crisis: How Much War Does Washington Want? By Paul Craig Roberts, posted March 26th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. On March 27th, Ukraine's interim coalition government announced concrete policy measures as part of its agreement with the IMF. A 50% increase of the retail price of gas, coupled with the deregulation of the foreign exchange market. In an address to Parliament on March 27th, following the confirmation of the IMF's pledged $18 billion loan, Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk warned that Ukraine was, quote, on the brink of the economic and financial bankruptcy, unquote. The proposed solution includes a significant increase in income taxes, a freeze on wages, curtailment of old age pensions, and higher energy prices. Under the Yanukovych government, Ukraine purchased more than half its natural gas from Russian Gazprom at 30% below its market value as part of a bilateral agreement with the Russian Federation. This government, integrated by neo-Nazis, has betrayed the people of Ukraine. That's from IMF Shock Treatment for Ukraine, Collapse of the Standard of Living by Michelle Chosadovsky, posted March 27th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Iran, 1953. Guatemala, 1954. Chile, 1973. There's a long history of the U.S. clandestinely undermining democratic governments around the world in order to assert their imperial control over strategic regions. The upheavals taking place currently in Ukraine and Venezuela recall these historic overthrows. We will examine the particular case of the Venezuelan uprising a little later, but first, we will get an overview of a handful of examples of Latin American democracies under siege. Joining us now by phone is Mady Darius Nazamroya. Nazamroya is an award-winning author and geopolitical analyst. Mady is the author of The Globalization of NATO and a forthcoming book, The War on Libya and the Recolonization of Africa. He is a sociologist and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization, and he was an observer at the recent El Salvador presidential elections. So, Mady, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you for having me again.
Okay, now maybe we'll start with the El Salvador elections. I noticed in a recent article you put forward, you did make a comparison with Venezuela in terms of, the sense that the main right of center party, ARENA, was contesting the results, and that was somewhat comparable to the previous Venezuelan presidential elections, and that you in some sense foresee that there are similar developments happening in El Salvador that could take them down the path of some sort of U.S. intervention of some sort. Do you want to develop that a little bit?
Well, I can tell you from the get-go that the advisors for most of these parties, from ARENA to the MUD in Venezuela, the MUD, and their presidential candidate are the same advisors. The advisor of ARENA in El Salvador, the presidential candidate, was also the advisor of the presidential candidate opposing the Chavistas in Venezuela. In fact, he came to El Salvador from neighboring Honduras, where he was also advising the freshly elected president there. There's also Colombia, where he was also an advisor there to the warlord president. So they have the same advisors. They support one another. And in fact, there was Venezuelans coming from the opposition parties in Caracas to El Salvador to support ARENA. And it's also important to note that ARENA, the people that are running it, and a lot of its supporters used to be part of the death squads in El Salvador. They were constructed and helped by the U.S. Military, by the Pentagon. Those death squads are what is commonly known outside of El Salvador as the Salvador option or the Salvadorian option. So that's ARENA's history and backbone. In regards to the strategy that they both have in common, well, both these parties refuse to recognize fair elections that have been internationally monitored, that have foreign observers coming, that also have systems of accountability that are even unparalleled here in Canada. I've worked for Elections Canada. I worked at Elections Canada for several different federal elections, and I can tell you as someone who's worked for Elections Canada that the safeguards that exist in El Salvador's electoral system are actually superior to ours. The system, for example, incorporates scrutineers under a legal footing from each one of the parties, like ours, but they go beyond that. They actually designate positions for each one of the parties involved. The main parties involved will have somebody present there, not as a scrutineer, but working the polls, which we don't. Here in Canada, of course, this does occur, but there's no official basis for it, unlike in El Salvador. For example, you might have a polling clerk be a liberal or a conservative, and usually a lot of politically driven individuals do get involved on election nights to work the polls for Election Canada. But in El Salvador, that's actually part of the system. So during the first round, you had the two main parties, which are the FMLN, or the Frente, and you had ARENA, and you had also one of the right-wing coalitions, which was a number of parties. Run by Tony Saca, who used to be a member of ARENA before he was kicked out. He used to be actually the president of El Salvador as well. So that's the electoral system there, and it's pretty fair. The margins for dishonesty or fraud, although there are attempts, are very slim. But you still have these parties refusing to recognize the election outcomes, and they have strategies to delegitimize fairly elected governments that were put into place through a democratic framework. You know, you have them actually calling for the use of the military for coup d'etats, you know. And that's actually something I spoke to people in El Salvador about, and I had colleagues who did survey work there, you know, focus groups, where they saw that supporters of ARENA happened to actually, they worded it differently. They wouldn't say outright coup d'etat, but they said that the military should intervene on behalf of our party to put us into power, basically. So they don't have a problem with using those means into getting into power. I mean, the standards are not the same. Democracy, mm-hmm. is only talked about or used as a measuring stick when they don't have power. But when they do have power, democracy's out of the door. All its years in the elections in El Salvador this year in 2014 were actually the fairest they've ever been, and the second free presidential elections there.
Okay.
I mean, the other presidential elections, there was a lot of fraud, and it was under Arena. Arena had a basic political hegemony in the presidential elections before that. So, I mean, before 2009. So they have no justifiable reasons mm-hmm. to say that these elections were unfair. And what they're doing is a strategy of destabilizing the government and delegitimizing it.
The current party in power, the FMLN, which is the, I guess, the left-of-center party, they are they won by a fairly slim margin, it seems, but at the same time, even having won, and even though there seems to be some favoritism toward, but on the part of, I guess, foreign interest, the United States in particular, the FMLN is not necessarily beyond being influenced by those U.S. proxies. Am I right about that?
Yeah, you are absolutely correct about that. I mean, there's a reality on the ground. Look, when they took over El Salvador, it was heavily in the orbit of the United States. It still is in the orbit of the United States. And it was the economy was totally under a neoliberal paradigm. I mean, they had to work with what they had. They came into this country where almost everything was privatized, where monopoly laws existed, and the U.S. influence is great, vast. They had to work with what they came into. And of course, even after the first round, they even talked the FMLN, the Frente, they talked to Tony Saca. You know, they talked to this gentleman who's from the right, you know, about getting support possibly from him. This was a man who was a rival of the FMLN. Still, he ran against them, but because of differences with Arena, he's talked to them. But I mean, in regards to El Salvador, you have to remember that the U.S. currency is their official national currency, thanks to Arena. You know, a few years ago, Flores, President Flores, who's now being, who's under criminal investigation, a criminal, he is, you know, for accepting bribes, for embezzlement, and so on. Well, he turned the U.S. currency into their official currency and got rid of their fiscal sovereignty by getting rid of the national currency and putting the U.S. dollar in its place. Not only is the U.S. dollar their official currency, like it is in other places in Latin America, such as Panama and Ecuador, which gives Washington a lot of leverage over these Latin American countries. But not only is the U.S. dollar their official currency in El Salvador, they also are heavily dependent on remittance payments, money being sent back by El Salvadorian living in the United States. So the Salvadorian population in the United States is sending money back, remittance payments, and El Salvador is one of the countries that has the highest dependency on that. It's almost 20%. It's something in the order of 17-20%. And the FMLN wants this to come down, of course. So that's a huge input into the national economy. And, of course, exports and imports, their main export and import partner is the United States. So they have to take all these things into consideration. The United States also supports a lot of their programs there. If they cut ties with the U.S. or do anything, well, they can't cut ties with the U.S., but if they do anything to jeopardize this, the United States can make the government collapse or the economy collapse. It actually has the power to do that. That's why they've been progressively trying to change things. I mean, there's arguments on how to change societies and what paces to go in, their leadership, there's divisions amongst the path they should take, but their leadership feels that this should be done in steady steps. So, for example, they've wanted to join ALBA, okay? But the Arena was in charge of government. Arena president said, no, we're not going to join ALBA, which is an economic and political alliance that was founded by Venezuela and Cuba, but it includes Nicaragua. Honduras was a part of it until the coup in Honduras. Nicaragua, I think I said, was a part of it. Ecuador is a part of it. Bolivia is a part of it. So El Salvador wanted to join this, but it couldn't enter. So they had to find another way of getting it to ALBA. So they went through the municipal route. So a lot of the municipal governments happened to be part of the FMLN. So what they did to join ALBA and to get cheap oil, Venezuelan oil, into the country, was they formed ALBA Petróleo. It's a company, publicly owned company, that's owned by the municipality association that involves the FMLN and by the National Oil Corporation of Venezuela. They created ALBA Petróleo, and it brought cheap fuel into the country. It's brought transport costs down in the country. It's brought a lot of the living costs down in the country and brought the standard of living up. For example, in El Salvador, before this move by the FMLN, they couldn't bring things from one place to another part of the country for sale because the fuel costs were too high. Okay, they had to actually import things. It was cheaper to buy an import from somewhere else than something from. And El Salvador is a very small country. It was cheaper to import something than to buy something from the other end of the country. But because the fuel costs were down, it's actually set things into motion where now they can trade things from one end of the country to another end of the country. And this is a very small country. I think it's the second smallest Latin American country. So they've worked to do all these things. They've gotten rid of the monopoly laws. They've pushed out Monsanto. They've tried to get rid of the bad pesticides that were being sold by the oligarchs. Medication was under a monopoly under one of the Arena oligarchs, who was selling actually expired medicine, bad medicine, and there was no legal way to get around it. So they've actually taken steps out of this. They've pushed for education to be more inclusive, to include more members of the population. They're providing supplies, shoes, food such as milk, food and anything nutritious for the students to go to school. They've steadily improved the country. In fact, they've improved the country to a point where even a lot of the local oligarchs are actually some of them are starting to come around and say, well, they're doing a better job of managing the economy, and they're starting to support the FMLN. Of course, there's a lot of contradictions in the country. There still is exploitation of workers. The Taiwanese, the Koreans, the Turks, they all have companies in El Salvador where they use, where they actually abuse workers. Of course, the FMLN is trying to clamp down on that, but it doesn't want to push out foreign capital. Yeah, as well. That's its dilemma.
As far as you've been able to determine, is this a kind of a constant for Latin America? Like every country is facing this kind of dilemma where you either have to you've surrendered a certain amount of your sovereignty already, and you essentially have to broker deals in order to achieve gains, such as the ones you mentioned with in El Salvador.
Okay, well, there's a lot of practical and theoretical arguments about all this. You know, there could be people who think that even a bit of a compromise is ideological erosion. You know, that's a point we should keep in mind. I think one factor in Venezuela, another factor we should keep in mind, is the role of the security and military apparatus. I mean, in Venezuela, In Latin America, most of the military forces, if not all, except for the exception of Venezuela, are either neutral politically, okay, or in the case of a lot of them, they are pro-American. They are tied to the United States. They have very close military-to-military relations, as they call it. There is a lot of politics intertwined in a revolving door between the military and the political establishment. We have that in North America too, but in the United States and Canada, but it's not as transparent as it is in Latin America, where the security military apparatus have a lot of control. In Venezuela, it's the only place in Latin America where the military is actually pro-government. And I think that's helped them a lot to withstand the tide, the siege against them. You know, the military is an important institutional player and an important institution in these Latin American countries. And in a lot of cases, between these progressive governments or whatever you'd like to call them, leftist governments, between them and the military, there are a lot of tensions. And they have to take careful steps not to aggravate the United States and their military and security apparatus. While in Venezuela, that's not the case. The military, because of Hugo Chavez's background in the military, because of him making sure that the rank and file and the officers in the armed forces were aligned to the government, you don't have the Venezuelan government being afraid of a coup d'etat or a junta being established vis-a-vis the armed forces. So that's one thing I've noticed. And like in El Salvador, you can see there's tensions when you speak about the military with government officials. I saw the same thing I've seen the same thing visiting other countries in Latin America where I've spoken to government officials, and there is this tension between them and the military. The military is a political actor one way or another in most Latin America. And one thing that has worked out for the current government in Venezuela is that the military is pro-government.
Mari, so when we're talking about, like, the divisions, are we talking about the way, I guess, like foreign observers tend to look at it as a left versus right divide, or is it a somewhat different orientation politically?
You've touched a topic that's dear to my heart. Because I've gone into a lot of arguments over certain aspects of it. You know, it touches on a broader question of what is left and what is right. You know, and we really, in a lot of cases, it's really relative. You know, one thing that's been a pet peeve of mine is I've seen people in North America, outside of Latin America, they speak about the government in Honduras like it was a left-wing government. When the ousted president was not a left-wing president. It was actually a right-wing government. But it was a right-wing government aligned to Venezuela. The president was aligned to Venezuela, and that was because he was a sovereign right-wing president. So people overlook that because of their ideological biases. They think that Honduras' president was left-wing. No, but it was an issue of sovereignty. What this comes down to, regardless of whether you support so-called left or so-called right, whatever they are, there's an issue of sovereignty here. And you'll notice that the actual right-wingers and left-wingers that support national sovereignty in many cases support one another. But against this tide of globalization, this neoliberal tide of globalization, which is basically run by Wall Street and a few other economic centers in the world. I've criticized some of the governments in Latin America, and I've gotten very bad feedback about it by people that consider themselves left-wing. When I point out to certain things, I say, well, those trade agreements are neoliberal. Well, this is neoliberalism. I mean, the best case is Lula's case. A lot of people have come around that. But when you speak about Lula's left-wing government in Brazil, I mean, it's a government that's actually the IMF darling was Lula. The best job for the IMF in terms of neoliberal structural reforms was by this so-called left-wing government. So people should not forget about those factors. And just because a government calls itself left-wing or not doesn't mean it really is left or right. They should look at the actions. The proof is in the pudding, they say.
Okay. Well, Maria, I think we have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for that fairly wide-ranging analysis of El Salvador and other countries in the region. Thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you for having me.
And we've been speaking with Mari Darias Nazam Roya, who's an award-winning author and geopolitical analyst and the research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Many commentators describe the protests happening in Venezuela currently as a purely domestic revolt against the failed policies of the Maduro government, although the allegation has been made that the protests currently sweeping Venezuela have been fostered and sponsored abroad, most notably from the United States. One of the analysts taking this view is James Petras. James Petras is a Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University, New York. He's the author of more than 62 books published in 29 languages and over 600 articles in professional journals. He has a long history of commitment to social justice, including an 11-year stint with the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil. And he's written extensively on subjects related to U.S. foreign policy and geopolitics. He is also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. He joins us from Binghamton. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Petras.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Now, first of all, can you maybe shore up that argument? Is there concrete evidence that the protests in Venezuela are indeed sponsored by the U.S. government?
There's absolutely no doubt. Washington has poured in approximately $10 to $20 million a year through its aid agencies, the National Endowment for Democracy, the Democratic Institute, the Republican Institute, Freedom House. They have been funding NGOs, so-called, that are engaged in opposition activities. They have supported the military civilian coup, business coup of 2002. They supported the lockout of the oil industry in 2003. They have funded groups that organize a referendum, which was defeated in 2004. They have been vociferous in their propaganda messages that have been in favor of the protesters, including in the present period. They've given wholehearted support to some of the most violent and destructive activities engaged in by street fighters and others in throughout Venezuela. We have no word from the United States denouncing the assassination of 7 policemen and National Guardsmen by snipers who are allied with the U.S.-supported opposition. The opposition is not what Secretary of State Kerry claims. They've already burned between 500 and 600 buildings, including social welfare distribution centers, publicly funded supermarkets with subsidized food, health clinics. They've assaulted delivery trucks. They've burned down police vehicles. They've engaged in barricades that have blocked traffic and have assaulted workers going to work or cleaning up the debris and barricades. So I think it's very clear that Washington is very deeply involved, very much involved in financing, very much engaged in organizing and funding direct action groups, as well as electoral campaigns and propaganda campaigns and media outlets. So I think it's impossible to say that the U.S. is out of the picture here. It's very much deeply involved, and its goal is to overthrow the democratically elected government. The recent escalation of violent protest, if we can call it that, I call it terrorism, is in the fact that they lost 2 recent elections. They lost the presidential elections by a close margin, And then they were trounced in the municipal and state elections in December by 10 points, 10 percentage points, 55 to 45. And they realized that having lost 18 of 19 elections, their chances of taking power or replacing the government through electoral channels are virtually nil. And so what I think they've decided on as a strategy is to create chaos, insecurity, and especially engage in violence that cuts the link between the government and the people. And that's why they're targeting the social programs, the subsidized food programs, the free health programs, the clinics, the experimental colleges. In other words, they want the programs that the government has funded and that creates a solid electoral majority to be broken. They want to break that link in order to be able to either directly overthrow the government or to create a negative image among the voters and defeat the government in the next election. One other important element here, and that is to create an ambience in which there is dual power, that the opposition with the gun in the street is really an alternative to the government, legitimate government. And they hope by creating this power centers, territorial centers, and institutional bases, they can win over sections of the military so that they can organize a coup. And that's why it's very important for the government to act much more forcefully in doing away with this terrorist onslaught.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that a lot of that's the support going to NGOs through the National Endowment for Democracy and a lot of the other activities. Are we talking about like the resources going to individuals, like salaries in some sense?
Well, or a lot of this is clandestine activity. What's on paper doesn't correspond to what is actually the use of the money. They can write up whatever they want. The fact is that the opposition has accumulated arms, rifles, even mortars. They've been able to purchase high explosive, blowing up electrical pylons and undermining the energy sources. They have been able to create professional militia armed paramilitary groups, that all of whom draw salaries and are engaged in this kind of well-armed activities. And I think it's part of it goes to subsidize the terrorists. Part of it goes to subsidize the media and the electoral activity. And part of it goes for arms purchases and the hiring of mercenaries.
Hmm. Now, these events, like this modern phase, if you could call it that, it started with student protests. I mean, are the students themselves being financed, or what's their motive?
Let me put it this way. There's been some students involved. That's not surprising. The Nazis first gained a majority in the universities among students. We've seen that in other countries where privileged universities become recruiting grounds for fascist organizations and terrorists. I think the key element here is to distinguish between the new universities, the Bolivarian universities, which don't charge tuition and have recruitment exams that are much more amenable to lower class entries to the universities. And we have some of the elite universities, which become the bulwarks of the opposition and provide sanctuaries for some of the terrorist activities. Carabobo University, for example, they found a whole stash of arms, munitions, and rifles and dynamite, etc. So I think one can't speak of the universities in the traditional sense. They serve as trampolines and recruiting grounds for some of the most violent activities. But having said that, one should recognize that among the 1,500 arrestees for violent activities, 900 of them are non-students. So about two-thirds of the arrestees are non-students, and a lot of these people have been recruited and paid for. And that is a key factor here, that you get not only students, but you get people engaged in violent activity who are non-students. Some of them were involved in drug trafficking, contrabands, paramilitary groups. Some have come from outside the country. One recent assassin was recruited, is of Chinese descent, trained in Chile, and imported into Venezuela. So I think one has to look beyond the student unrest as the key factor here, and looking at this shock troops of the oligarchy, as I call them.
Hmm. Now, in your recent article, you introduced it by saying that a representative of the of the Venezuelan National Guard, Captain Jose Guillen Araque, had warned the President Maduro that fascism has to be defeated before it's too late. That is a sincere concern that you have, that Venezuela is...
These terrorists are not interested in majority rule. They're not interested in elections. They're interested in overthrowing the government through force and violence, and they represent a minority of the country. Moreover, if you look at their practice and their targets, overwhelmingly are working-class institutions. Their trade unions, their peasant cooperatives, their subsidized supermarkets, their clinics that serve the poor. There's not a single big business interest that's been affected. The total violence is directed against working-class institutions, peasant institutions, community-based services, etc. Not a single private clinic in upper-class areas has been targeted. Not a single bank has its windows broken. Not a single manufacturer has been kidnapped or assassinated. This is class warfare, class hatred, class violence, and it's directed against the working class, typical of any fascist group. They have the support of the oligarchs in terms of finance, in terms of media propaganda, and in terms of their backing from the United States. So I think the ingredients of a fascist movement here is very clear. A fascist doesn't have to be an anti-Semit. They can be profoundly anti-Afro-Indian Venezuelan. That's where the hatred, during the time of Chavez, the constantly bizarre caricatures of Chavez looking as a gorilla. Chavez, of course, was 10 Afro-Amerindian descent. So there's a racism, there's class violence, there's violent minority trying to seize power. And so what some purists might say, some academic Marxist might say, is, well, they don't have a nationalist ideology. They're really tools of the United States, and that's different from what took place in Nazi Germany. That may be the case, but in other instances, in other dimensions, this terrorism from proxy is directed at destroying institutions of democracy and working class representation, and that's the key to fascism.
you did mention that this is just one of many attempts by the U.S. to undermine those institutions. I mean, we can think of the, I guess it was April of 2002, where there was a coup, but that there was a counter coup, which restored Chavez back to power. And then right up to the last election, where there was, clear attempts to try to manipulate the election, again, foreign sponsored. But it seems like the events... It seems like the events that we're witnessing right now, it seems to be much more intense, and the probably the most serious threat that's been faced since Chavez came to power. What seems to be different this time? Why does it seem to be more forceful than those other?
I think Washington is on a violent wave. I think the Obama administration, after the bombing of Libya, the recruitment, the mass recruitment of mercenaries and extremists in Syria. I think the power grab in the Ukraine, it's very clear Washington is escalating its aggression. And I think Obama in particular wants to compensate for some of the losses that they experienced in the late part of the 21st the first decade of the 21st century. They can't bully Russia anymore. Yeltsin is gone. China has become the second world power. The U.S. is lost and is retreating in Afghanistan. The U.S. had to leave Iraq. Sanctions did not tumble the government in Iran. Obama is economically has not been able to revitalize the U.S. economy. So I think all of this aggression is part of an effort to compensate for the economic decline of the U.S. through military means. And Venezuela just is part of this global pattern encircling Russia, building military bases surrounding China. I think it's a grand expression of impotence in search for a lost past. And I think Obama, in particular, Kerry is one of the mouthpieces. Nuland in the Ukraine, I mean, the arrogance and the sense that they have to recapture the period in which the U.S. was the uncontested power in the world, the 90s. I think there's a lot of, I won't call it nostalgia, but a looking back and seeing how can we reconstruct the unipolar aggressive world of the 90s. And I think that they failed to realize that Venezuela is different from what the U.S. was conventionally dealing with in Latin America, where it just lined up a few military people and oligarchs, overthrew a government, went on its way, as they did in Honduras. That Venezuela is not Honduras, and Russia is under Putin is not Yeltsin. China of 2014 is not China of the 1980s. I think they don't realize, or they can't come to terms with the changing power relations in the world, and bullying and power grabbing and financing terrorists. These are the only available instruments they have. They don't have a political opposition to topple Putin. They don't have dissidents Tiananmen Square to topple China. Their opposition has failed electorally in 18 out of 19 elections in Venezuela. Consistently lost electorally. So I think the resort to terrorism and fascism in Venezuela is part of this alternative path, just like the coup and the junta in Ukraine was the path, having lost the elections in the Ukraine. They resorted to this putsch and power grab by this coalition of neoliberals and neo-fascists. I think the U.S. has relying more on the riffraff of the world in terms of organizing these kinds of extra-parliamentary power grabs. Mm.
But are there not individuals involved in these protests who are definitely feeling that they need a change?
There are problems, but they're not problems to be resolved through firebombing medical centers. I think this is clear. There may be a great deal of discontent with inflation in Venezuela, but the mass of the people that are complaining about that, first and foremost, are Democrats. Secondly, they believe in electoral politics or engaging in peaceful strikes and collective bargaining. They're not part of an oligarchy that's going to be the main beneficiary of a coup. They, in the worst of cases, they're the cannon fodder that march in these demonstrations and who'll be discarded like a used condom once there is a power change. And let me be absolutely clear. The Venezuelan democracy and the Venezuelan socialist program is supported by millions of people. Just overthrowing the government and the palace of Miraflores is not going to be enough. There's going to be hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans in the streets. In order to shore up a junta, a coup government, they're going to have to kill tens of thousands of Venezuelans. It's going to make Indonesia once over, as they did in the 1966 coup. 1 million Indonesians were killed, and I suspect dozens of thousands of Venezuelans will be killed in any post-coup period. So we're not just talking about regime change. We're talking about the slaughter of tens of thousands of workers and Democrats who stand up to defend their institutions, their social gains, their social advancement. So I think we're talking about serious business, and that's why I'm a strong advocate that the government declare martial law and face up to the fact that they are in a war with a U.S.-backed terrorist proxy.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably that might make it difficult for progressive figures on the on the world stage, this idea of invoking martial law. I think there's definitely an allergy to that.
When three people were killed in Boston, the National Guard and the police took over the city. There was no one could move out of their house. They broke doors. They went in neighborhoods. They took over houses. That's just three people killed in one incident. We've got 35 people killed, 7 policemen and guardsmen, and thousands of people and buildings that have been destroyed. If the U.S. can justify virtual martial law because of one bombing, what can we say in favor of Venezuela taking the same kind of measure, facing an unrelenting war sponsored and supported by the U.S. government?
Okay, well, I'm also looking at this whole idea of, I mean, basically we're talking about imperialism, right? U.S. imperialism, where they're trying to deal with these troublesome governments that are standing in the way of their ambitions. And I guess there's this approach of it's this sort of supporting these people on the ground to sort of overthrow their own governments. And then there's the way that we're, a lot of us are more familiar with, this overt militarism, such as in Vietnam and Iraq.
It's very difficult. The U.S. public is overwhelmingly opposed to ground troops anywhere in the world. The polls have been absolutely explicit that over two-thirds of the American public is opposed to the U.S. engaging in wars with Iran, with Syria, engaging in any invasion of Ukraine. There is what the bourgeois scholars call intervention exhaustion, which in our terms is people opposed to more imperialist wars, which lead to huge budget deficits and social cuts and negligence of reconstructing the economy in the United States. So the use of drones, the use of special forces, the use of proxies, the use of the riffraff of the world has become the weapons of choice for the U.S. in engaging in these kinds of imperial interventions.
Even if the United States is unsuccessful with getting the regime they want in power, might it not be sufficient for them to merely destabilize Venezuela?
Well, I don't think a viable government. The problem is there's so many built-in mechanisms today in Venezuela that any pro-U.S. regime is going to find it enormously difficult even to stabilize itself, let alone denationalize the economy and negate the social programs. There's thousands of community councils that are deeply embedded in Venezuela. There are trade unions that cover most major industries. There's peasant cooperatives that have received land in land reform programs. To try to revert that, to try to impose an IMF austerity program, to denationalize the Venezuelan oil industries, to cut back on the social programs, you're asking for a major civil war, and whatever happens in overthrowing Maduro, if that takes place, there's going to be prolonged warfare, which will impose enormous obstacles to the U.S. consolidating a new puppet regime in Venezuela.
So what's at stake then? Are we talking about another Chile 73 scenario?
Well, that's what they're shooting for. They want to start the civil discord. They want the armed forces to undermine the social programs. They want to create a dual power so the military that are vacillating, if they exist, have an alternative, political alternative. They're doing all of this. I lived through Chile, and I was advising the government. I left just before the coup because I was dismayed by the conciliatory posture of the government. Workers were demanding arms. The government stayed within the constitutional norms, which were totally out of date and out of context. And I prefer jailing a couple thousand right-wing terrorists and their political and economic mentors, putting those couple thousand or so in jail and saving the lives of tens of thousands of workers. Those of us who've gone through this kind of fascist power grab and lose friends and comrades and colleagues understand that the only way to deal with fascists that are seeking to grab power is to use superior force.
Okay. Well, Professor Petras, very much appreciative of that analysis. I want to thank you very much for agreeing to be my guest on the Global Research News Hour.
Okay, thank you very much, and keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with James Petras. He is Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in New York. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.